Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that translates legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams-Byers. And today, we're going to discuss President Joe Biden's proposals announced recently to alter the Supreme Court of the United States. His pronouncements come after several major ethical questions about some of the justices and some decisions that rocked the legal world, including one granting presidents almost total immunity from criminal prosecution. Hi, Gail.
Judge, how are you?
I'm doing well. We've got a lot of chew on here, and I want to jump in. Let me just do a little stage setter, and then we'll jump into the proposals themselves. President Biden made his announcement of he sort of hinted he was going to do this, but he made his announcement of judicial reforms for the Supreme Court in an op-ed piece in the Washington Post. That strikes me as strange. Before we get into the merits, what do you think about that?
You know, I think for his standard, it is strange. I say that because as a nation, we've become accustomed to the president's communications to the rest of the nation in a far more formal manner. In a formal setting. And generally, when presidents lay out policies or legislative agendas, they'd like to have supported first by the people and then by the people's representatives. There's usually kind of a pecking order to this. But I would also say, and I appreciate you saying, hey, an op-ed in the Washington Post kind of strikes as the less formal way to make this announcement. But remember, if you'll remember, we had prior administrations who made policy pronouncements on Twitter. And, you know, there were some of us who were afraid that we might learn that we're in the midst of World War III because we learned about it on social media, because there was just no real decorum, if you will, to the pronouncement of policy. So although this is a departure, and I do agree, I just think that, you know, perhaps we should be certainly more forgiving and a little more malleable when we learn how some of these pronouncements have gone, because maybe what we're learning is just this is just a different way for the executive branch to do business, because we certainly got, I think, a trial by fire experience with, you know, using social media as the platform to announce major policy shifts. And so this ain't social media, but it's also not the White House press room.
I guess I'm just old school. I expect some kind of presidential announcement, if not a speech, at least something issued from the White House, as opposed to an op-ed piece. And for people who may not understand what an op-ed piece is, let me give you a quick and dirty definition. Back in the old days of newspapers, if you can remember back then.
When they existed.
When they existed, there was an editorial page, and it was always on the left side. It was an odd-numbered or an even-numbered page, and it was on the left side of the fold of your newspaper, and that had editorials and sometimes letters to the editor and sometimes columns from newspaper people. And then on the right side, the page opposite of the editorial page, was a place where people stated their opinions. It's sometimes experts on all kinds of issues. And it was called an op-ed piece. Sometimes they were solicited by the newspapers. Sometimes they were not. Sometimes people just volunteered them and the newspaper thought they were worth printing. So that's what an op-ed piece is. And he chose to do that in the Washington Post to make these serious announcements. Now, one reason I think, Gail, that he may have done this is because he wanted to choose his words very carefully in doing this. This is something that, you know, we have looked at for a long time is Supreme mm-hmm. Court reform.
Absolutely.
And I think he wanted to be just as precise as he could in exactly what he was asking for.
And I suspect that in addition to being precise, and, you know, who knows how many times this piece was wordsmithed, right, to make sure it said exactly what it's supposed to say and no more, but clearly the message. But also, I think there is something to be said for a president who's been in public service for 5 decades and also still respects the separation of powers. And despite disagreement, is still, even with declining approval, he's still respectful and deferential to the other branches of government, even in disagreement. And I think, again, he's trying to continue to lead by example, because at the end of the day, I believe that he has a deep and abiding appreciation for the fact that even in the face of strong disagreement and, you know, policy opinions and goals and even positions for the trajectory of the country, democracy cannot continue to thrive if we are always coloring the lines, we're blurring the lines, we are, you know, creating new lanes, if you will, or disregarding lanes and taking over other branches of government, which is completely an opposite to what the framers intended when setting up these three separate yet co-equal branches of government. Yes, there are mechanisms in place to put checks and balances on each, but I think the operative phrase is checks and balances, not takeovers and tyranny. And so he, I think, is very careful in saying, I believe our democracy becomes stronger by placing these additional guardrails in place as it relates to the Supreme Court, because the rest of democracy is depending upon our faith in the justice system. And it's right now is fraying.
He also, in his piece, outlined that he probably has more experience than anyone in government dealing with the courts, and especially the Supreme Court of the United States. During his time as senator, he was a longstanding chair of the Senate Judiciary
Committee,
then vice president, which is the president of the Senate, that has the role of affirming justices for the Supreme Court and all federal judges,
yes,
for that matter. And then as president, so he set up his credentials to talk about this. Now, before we get into the three things that he mentioned in his op-ed piece, there is one paragraph that I want to read to you that it's a short paragraph, but he said this, quote, "I have great respect for our institutions and separation of powers. What is happening now is not normal, and it undermines the public confidence in the court's decisions, including those impacting personal freedoms. We now stand in a breach." Now, that's one paragraph that summarizes a whole hell of a lot.
Oh, does it? And I think it strikes at exactly what I was just saying, is he's not lost respect and deference for the judiciary as a branch, what he is signaling very loudly is what many have termed an existential threat. And we've heard existential threat in a lot of different, in reference to a lot of different things relative to how things are being handled now. But when it comes to our bedrock of democracy, the justice system, the thing that actually held, I believe, the entire country together, even after experiences on January 6th, which was the fact that we could seek recourse in the courts when we had the 2020 election. And there were, you know, frequent allegations of wrongdoing at the ballot box and the polls. The first place to seek redress was the courts, and to rely upon not the legislature, not the executive branch, but to rely so heavily on the judicial branch to fairly, objectively, thoughtfully, and reverently respond to each and every one of these instances and issues unto themselves. And yes, sometimes they had sweeping responses and results, but each one was unto itself. But it was the thing that we all said, okay, the court has spoken, and this is what the court has, this is what several courts have found, and they've been consistent. And you know, it goes to what my Southern mama would say when something like that happens, and you proclaim one thing and others are proclaiming something else. My Southern mama would say, everybody ain't lying on you. And so when we think about, you know, how things kind of collided after the 2020 election, and then after the 6th of January, we relied as a nation so heavily on the justice system from every corner of the nation. And ultimately, almost in unison, they spoke with one voice as it relates to those things. So everybody wasn't lying on you. And then we come to now these more current or recent moments in history, which have been a departure from what we expect from our justice system. And part of it,
where he says it's not normal.
It's not normal. It is not. I mean, Judge, let's think about it. We know, or we at least perceive from our vantage point, that there's been forum shopping that's been designed to place certain cases in front of the Supreme Court only after certain justices have been seated. That is neither what the system was designed for, nor is it normal for us to expect a system, even if it's out of bounds of design, and it nonetheless ends up that way. It is not normal to expect that the justice system will respond to it the way that it has. And so what if the intent was to create a majority conservative Supreme Court? That may be the intent, but for everybody else, every other American should rely upon the idea that notwithstanding conservative values, we will still expect this court, this body, this collection of exceptionally, you know, brilliant jurists that have been given to us by our other, you know, highest offices in the land, we expect them to respond in a way that still acknowledges the norms that we've come to rely upon. And that, I think, is the departure he was speaking of.
Let me also put some perspective in here. The Supreme Court now has the lowest public trust and confidence rating in over 40-some years. Over four decades.
Now they're rivaling their legislative counterparts.
And in 2023 was the first time in that 40-some years that the unfavorable rating for the Supreme Court outpolled the favorable rating of the Supreme Court. So it is a time where people are sort of fed up with the Supreme Court. And that, I think, prompted President Biden to do this, to come out with these reforms, because he was reluctant to start tinkering with the court. You know, he's danced all around it for 3.5 years. And just recently was he prompted to do this when it looks like the American public is demanding something. So there are three things that the president proposed in his op-ed piece, and one thing that he didn't. And I want to talk about all four, Judge Gale, if we can, but I want to talk about them in order so that our listeners don't get confused. So the first thing I want to talk about between you and me is the 18-year term limits that have been proposed by President Biden. Now, again, some context, all federal judges are appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate. That includes all the Supreme Court justices and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and they're appointed for life. Now, there are some caveats. The Constitution actually says they're appointed for a period of good behavior, but that means unless they're convicted of some crime, that means probably that they're there for life. Mm-hmm. This would be a change to that, and an 18-year term limit, one, is sort of a radical approach to this, but the way that that would work, I think each president would get every 2 years or so, there would be a new appointment. So almost every president would be able to make an appointment to the Supreme Court, which has not always been the case. But what are your thoughts on an 18-year term limit for justices to the Supreme Court?
Well, I'll say, you know, certainly as to the concept and the idea of term limits, I don't know that that's something I necessarily reject at all. I quite frankly think that democracies were built to pass the baton. I don't think that public service as a career was ever the real natural intent for when the framers created, you know, this great thing that we enjoy. I think there was perhaps the intention that individuals would certainly, you know, give up some parts of their life so that they can contribute to the building and maintenance of a great country, and then they would go on with their lives. And somewhere along the line, that became longer and longer terms, that became consecutive terms. And as you said, with regard to the justices of the Supreme Court, that became, you know, a lifetime gig or a lifetime job. And the thing of it is, I don't know where 18 came from. I'm not sure if that was, you know, some kind of mental negotiation of the president. And so he couldn't quite get to 20 or 25, but, you know, 18 just sounded like a good number. So I'm not certain where the calculus came in on 18, but here's what I will say is that I do believe that that is, you know, whereas before we may not have felt like we necessarily, you know, needed those types of restrictions or guardrails, I certainly see now that as we progress in society, as things become more innovative and sophisticated, that as we are moving light speeds ahead of ourselves in so many ways, that it is important to have a judiciary that can thoughtfully and readily respond to that in keeping with how times are changing. And that, you know, there are those who are, you know, I think are hearkening back to what they call the good old days. Well, I'll tell you, you probably can't talk to, you know, anyone who's between the ages of, you know, 18 and 36 that'll have any idea of what that means. But they are being governed by individuals at the highest court in the land who have no ability to really understand or connect with them or appreciate kind of their lives in the moment that it's in. So I actually agree with not only imposing term limits, but I think the one part of this this recommendation by the president was that should it pass, it would make the imposition of the 18-year term limits retroactive, which means for those who have been on the bench for the 18 years or more, that they would immediately be required to leave the bench. You've done your time, you've done your job, you should enjoy your retirement anywhere but where you are right now. And that I don't think that is a bad idea. I actually think it's a well-reasoned one, because it also ensures that the decisions made by this court can not only be revisited, but they'll be revisited in the context of its current application, as opposed to decisions being made that can affect and impact many, many, many generations without any potential or hope for change. That's not fair.
The justices that the longest sitting justices would be Clarence Thomas, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Alito, and Justice Kagan. They were the longest. They've been on the bench the longest. When I worked as a judicial fellow at the court in the late 80s, speak about longevity, there was a justice on the court, William Brennan, who ironically was one of the most liberal justices on the court, had been appointed by President Eisenhower back in the early 1950s.
Isn't it stunning? You know,
so a new president, say former President Trump, gets elected in November, and there comes a vacancy. He could appoint somebody under the current status in their 40s. And if that person would get rubber stamped by the Senate, that person could be on the court for 40 years.
That's
40
true.
Years.
Yep.
And so the 18-year term limit, you know, is radical. It's very radical. And the scholars right now are debating, you know, is this something Congress can act on, or is this something we need a constitutional amendment on? President Biden thinks it's something that Congress can act upon, but I know there will be debate about that, how this would even go into effect, and would this impact other federal judges or just be for justices of the Supreme Court? That was unclear as well.
Correct. I mean, I think maybe purposely so, because these policy pronouncements and these recommendations, I think, do deserve input from the legislative branch. There may be some legislators who would like an opportunity to maybe even better refine these proposals. And again, I don't think that it is a bad idea to address this, but I also think it is both fair and objective. When you named the four justices that would be affected by the triggering of this law were it to go into effect, it doesn't target democratically appointed justices or Republican appointed justices. The rule is standard across the board for any justice who's reached that particular limit or time period of serving, which I think helps to infuse a little more faith and fairness in this process, because that's one of the primary things that folks are missing right now, is the fact that they just don't have a lot of faith, first in the court itself. They lack faith in a lot of things the court has done, both as it relates to them and as it relates to case decisions. And they also have lost faith in the desire, willingness, or ability of the other branches of government to put proper checks and balances on it. And so people feel hopeless.
Well, this was the most radical of the suggestions, I think, the 18-year term limits.
I like it. Here's what I'll tell you. I remember when I was elected to the bench in 2012, and the judge that was there previously had left the bench because of required age limits. Now, remember what the president has proposed here by 18-year term limit isn't all that different from what many, many, many states across the nation impose on their state elected or appointed judges. But they just impose them based on age as opposed to time served. And so, as for example, in Ohio, if you've reached the age of 70, if you are in the middle of a term, you can complete your term. You just can't run again. If you will, if you are already, or if you're going to be 70, then you should probably consider whether or not you're going to be able to serve. Now, actually, if you are not even 70 before you run, you can actually run, win the seat, and serve for 6 years, and you'll be 76 or so by the time you leave the bench, but you'll just be barred from running after that. Again, that's not really different. That's just a form of putting in what are, often considered reasonable restrictions on who should be sitting on the bench making these decisions. And I don't think that the Supreme Court justices should be excluded from that consideration. But when I had that same example in the court where I took the bench as the first African-American elected to that seat in that city's history, I recall a conversation with my predecessor who offered to come back as a consultant for the court. Now, aside from the fact that, there was absolutely no support, and I was struggling to find the genuineness in that request or even that offer, my response was, hey, there's a reason why you're not here. And you're not here because the law says you've aged out. So here's what I need to do. I need to respect your right to retire in peace. So I'm going to do everything I can to not bother you once you've left. And the same thing ought to bode true for justices and maybe even other federal judges. We need to respect your right to have your golden years be golden. Goodbye.
Item number two.
And mind you, this is coming from two retired judges, so the nerve of us, right?
That's right. Item number two probably has the biggest public support, I would suggest. And that is President Biden is calling for a binding enforceable ethics code for justices. And this includes, quote, disclose gifts, refrain from public activity, or public political activity, I should say. Disclose gifts, refrain from public political activity, and recuse themselves from cases in which they or their spouse have financial or other conflicts of interest. Now, the Supreme Court passed. They said, okay, we've got a code of ethics this past year, but
it's written in invisible ink.
The fatal flaw that is, as you said, it's written in invisible ink, in that there was no enforcement mechanism. There was no way of triggering anything if somebody chose to violate it. I guess everybody threw up their hands and went, oh, well.
Like, this is a great thing, except it's worthless, right?
This one would be an enforceable ethics code. And one more thing before I pass it on to you, and that is Justice Kagan. She came out this week at a judicial conference in out west in California. She's the head of the Ninth Circuit as well as being a justice of the Supreme Court. And she said that she would support a creation of a committee of federal judges to examine potential violations of the new ethics code. She is the only justice, mm-hmm. the only justice that has come out and said, we need an enforcement mechanism. That, to me, is astounding.
And to show you what the enforcement mechanism should look like, right? So at least she's articulated.
Let's have a bunch of federal judges. Let's appoint a committee, and they're the enforcement. I mean, this happens state after state after state after state. All 50 states have an enforcement mechanism on the code of ethics for judges.
Exactly.
The federal government, the federal judges have an enforceable code of ethics. Only the Supreme Court does not.
Right. And so it's funny when you were saying that, the first thing that came to mind is, I know Judge Tom can't see me, but I am like standing and clapping. And I'm standing and clapping because we've done episodes previously where we've talked about the failing of this particular component alone, what that does when it comes to respecting the institution of the court and how others are expected to respond to it. When you have an entire system where essentially the rules don't apply to me, they apply to everybody else, but they don't apply to me, then you certainly create an environment that naturally breeds animus. People are going to be angry and upset, as they should be. And again, I don't know why more judges themselves are not up in arms, because understand, especially federal judges, the code of ethics that exists absolutely applies to them. It applies to you and I. It applies even when we, you know, sit by assignment. Rules still apply. And whether they apply to you as a judge or they just apply to you as a lawyer, what we understand is, you know what? This license means something, and I have to color inside the lines and play by the rules in order for it not to be jeopardized. But then on top of that, to have an entire group of judges of whom you're expected to revere and respect because they hold the highest office in the judiciary that this land acknowledges, and to know that that group has created, you know, something that perhaps might be maybe with a generous reading akin to an ethics code, but then to know that the whammy comes in, because even if you agree that it is a code of ethics, there's no way to make them abide by it, is insulting and laughable. You know, it reminds me of a time, my dad is a big practical joker, and he would always play jokes on my siblings and I. And one year, after a bit of back and forth, Judge, we got him back. And so I don't even know where I found this, but every now and then my dad would buy lotto tickets and he'd buy the scratch offs. Well, I somehow came across some fake lotto tickets that all of them were winners, all of them. And I think it was Father's Day. And I bought him this car and I put one of those fake lotto tickets in there and gave it to him. And I sat there and I watched quietly because I knew he'd scratch it off and he'd win. Why'd the lotto ticket say he won $1 million? My father was over the moon happy. I mean, he was like, he's making plans. Life just changed in a moment. And this kind of reminds me of this, you know, essentially this fake ethics code. We saw it. It looks great. It's wonderful. Life just changed in a moment. They're going to abide by some rules. And then my dad flips it over and it talks about the redemption policy, like how to actually collect on this lotto ticket. And it says, you know, make sure you contact Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy, or it's going through this list.
Right.
And he's reminded that this is absolutely worthless. And that is exactly how I felt about the Supreme Court when they were left to their own devices to develop an ethics code that would actually have enforceability, power, and structure in it. It felt like reading the back of my father's fake lotto ticket that said, yeah, you won $1 million, but there's no way to collect it. And that's exactly who these guys were in that regard. And I charge John Roberts, Justice Roberts, with this, because as the leader of the court, it was his responsibility and his obligation to ensure that he dealt faithfully with the American people. And in fair dealing, you don't just put out a code and say, hey, we've checked one half of the box, but we're not going to go the whole way because we don't have to. That is insulting.
I wrote a column about that, if you recall. Needed a little blue pill of courage.
That's right. That's right. But
to set forth an enforceable code of ethics.
Indeed. And I do. I agree with you. I think that no matter what side of the aisle you're on, that if you are in any environment that imposes rules that govern your behavior, either inside that profession or inside of that environment, that you're looking to these same folks to be governed as well. And what we've learned is self-policing doesn't work. They have not done a good job of self-policing. And after all, they've reminded us that they're human. And that they would do no different than what most other people would do if left to their own devices and there were no checks and balances in place. You will take advantage of the environment after a while. Now, you may not do it as soon as you get there. You may not do it the first couple years or so. But once you realize that there's nobody guarding the hen house, all bets are off. I'll do whatever I want to. That's why you can also have justices cavalierly say there's no mechanism in the Constitution that says anyone can police or control us. That, I think, is, again, I think that's offensive to say to people whose lives are governed by your decisions.
And I think President Biden was wise in that he put in his op-ed piece, refrain from public political activity. That's obviously aimed at Justice Alito's flags issue with his spouse.
What, you mean the guy who don't know how to take a flag down on his own house?
Yeah, that's the guy. Disclose gifts, obviously, towards Clarence Thomas and the millions of dollars he's received in gifts, some reported and some not. And then recuse themselves from issues where their spouse may have a financial or, I love this word, other conflicts. Well, Clarence Thomas's wife is a major advisor to former President Trump, a major conservative lobbyist and fundraiser.
And also, apparently, she really likes outings, such as rallies, gatherings, and protests, especially when they're on the ellipse.
And yes, she does do that. And then Justice Alito's wife, who claims that she was the reason for the maggot sympathizing flags, well, that would be, I guess, under the category other conflicts of interest, not financial. Now, the reality
these are all
of these
conflicts that, as judges and lawyers, you and I see very plainly. We see it as clearly as, I don't know, not expecting bones and boneless chicken. Some of these things are just that kind of common sense. But for others, these are, you know, these things are like, you know, ultra ridiculous to them, but they make like perfect sense to everyone else. You don't have to be a lawyer to know that if you take state level judges, Your Honor, and you bring anybody off the street, you walk them into the courtroom and you tell them that they are charged with an offense and you're expecting this judge to be fair to make a determination in your case. But all of a sudden, the judge starts laughing, talking, cackling, and making fun with the prosecutor as if they go way back. And then at some point you hear them say, you know, well, hey, are you going to have lunch with my wife? Are you going to hang out with my son? And you're now thinking, wait a minute, I don't know how fair this is going to be. I don't know how disinterested this person is in my case. I actually think the fix is in. Well, the fix has at least felt like it was in for many in the American public, not because the judges lack the ability to be objective, but we have to be honest about being skewed and potentially skewed or the perception of being skewed when you have other interests at bay. And that's exactly what happened here. And it was a complete lapse in just personal judgment. Even if you didn't think of it as a professional responsibility, at the end of the day, personally, you have an obligation to maintain integrity on a personal level. And I think they failed spectacularly.
Well, let me move to some facts here because, and I think these support exactly what you're saying, Judge. If you look at the most recent polls, 50% of Americans support term limits for Supreme Court justices, and 60% favor a code of ethics because that's what the rest of the world lives by.
Indeed.
Yeah, that's what the rest of the world lives by. So even though there's that kind of public support, really, these two items that we've been talking about are aspirational because let's say that they both have to go through Congress. Well, that means that both of them have to get 60 votes in the Senate and both of them have to pass the House. Well, all of a sudden, I mean, seconds after Biden's op-ed piece hit the streets and hit the internet, Speaker Johnson of the House of Representatives, Speaker of the House, said these are dead on arrival. They're not going to make any progress whatsoever. Now, how does the American public feel like that, feel about that? When they look at the percentages, 50% want term limits and 60% want a code of ethics, but they're dead on arrival.
Indeed. I think there are often, you know, people inside of representative government who are not always operating from a standpoint of representing the interests of the people who have placed them there. Sometimes, and many times, it is a matter of consolidating political party support and cementing that as opposed to responding to the desires of the constituents that have entrusted you to be there. And so to that, I think, quite frankly, it's a really simple fix. If this 50 and 60% of the American public truly desire this change at this level and they understand, so, you know, this is, folks, this is another kind of lesson from Schoolhouse Rocky. If you understand that in order to get the change on the Supreme Court, in the direction that you desire, that it's not going to happen internally. So they're not going to police themselves and they're not going to impose these rules on themselves. But if the legislative branch is entrusted with imposing these rules on the Supreme Court so as to respond to the desires of that 50 and 60%, then it's a really easy equation. The other side of the equal sign is really easy. That means you have to make sure you are voting the people into the legislative branch who are going to absolutely respond affirmatively to that 50 and 60% lack of favorability rating. So you have to elect and you have to vote members of Congress, both the House and the Senate, who will ensure that these are the priorities of your community. You're the constituent. You hire them. They don't hire you. They are in office because you have elected them, not because they have some birthright to it. And if that is what you as a voting public want, then you have to ensure that your vote matters by placing the people in positions to deliver just that on behalf of you and your families and your neighborhoods and your communities and your state and so on. That's how you get it done. It is absolutely a process. It's not always easy. It means changing perhaps, you know, one Congress member at a time or one senator at a time, but it can be done. And if you need 60 votes, then guess what? Again, you know the math. Just look at the balance in each house and do the math so you know how many you need and you know what work needs to be done in order to get it done. And if it doesn't happen because you've been apathetic, or it doesn't happen because you decided you didn't think it would really happen, then don't be surprised at what you continue to get out of now the cemented and stationary government you enjoy right now. Don't be surprised.
I'll tell you, people out there can tell, I'm sure, listening to this, that these are emotional issues for us. And I hate to break in, but we have to move on. We've got about 15 minutes left, and I've got two issues yet to talk about. So,
my mother-in-law will be disappointed. Word in edgewise. There you go, Tom.
the third thing that President Biden moved forward with was a constitutional amendment prohibiting blanket immunity for presidents. This basically is a constitutional amendment reversing what the Supreme Court decided on July 1st in the case of Trump versus the United States. Now, this talk about aspirational. To get a constitutional amendment, you have to have 2/3 vote of each house. So that's 2/3 of 100 in the Senate, 2/3 of 435 in the House. Both of them have to vote. And then you need approval from 3/4 of the states. So constitutional amendment is not easy. It's sometimes much easier at a state level where you can have referenda and so forth. But on the federal level, not so easy. Why is he making this statement if it's not going to happen?
Well, I agree first. It's a heavy lift. It's not impossible because as a country, we've done it before, right? We've amended the Constitution many times. So insofar as, yes, as it seems like a pipe dream or pie in the sky, I just want to kind of quell some of the largest detractors and say, listen, you know, we've done this before. We would not have had freed slaves but for constitutional amendments. We would not have women voting but for constitutional amendments.
And so prohibition and non-prohibition.
Exactly, but for constitutional amendments. So it can be done. And one thing I'll say, without pointing fingers one way or another, when it comes to political parties, I will tell you there is one party in particular that has mastered the long game. And in order to achieve constitutional amendments of this nature, this is a long game. Some want really quick responses, but remember, you didn't get the Dobbs decision overnight. That was the long game. That had been something that had worked for a long time.
And since 1973.
Exactly. It took 5 decades. So if this is a constitutional amendment, although aspirational right now, if the goal is to ultimately get that done, because who knows what kind of havoc could be wreaked between now and the time that it is actually codified, if there's still a democracy, it absolutely would be necessary, but this is long gaming it. And so I do think, however, putting this out there, and of course you had certain others who were immediately opposed to it, and I think they may have been immediately opposed to it when maybe they thought or believed that the likelihood that the November election would turn a certain way might be favorable to them. I mean, it's far less likely now, so it seems. And so this may be the very ruling that they wish they never had if the outcome is not what they hope or anticipate to be. That is something that I would, you know, seriously look at and think about.
The worm might turn, so to
speak. Yeah, yeah. I mean, think about it. You know, it's all good.
And it's all good fine right now for,
Until it's not.
For those people who wanted it, right?
It's good until it's not. Wait until there's an outcome you didn't anticipate. And you're like, hey, what about that constitutional amendment you were talking about? About that limiting the power? You know, the one that vests immediately. But yeah, how about that amendment? How about we go back to that?
Mm-hmm. The one that changes from a democracy to an autocracy.
This ain't really what we had in mind for that. We were actually kind of banking on something else and maybe setting things up for that thing. Who knew it would turn this way? You're right. Who knew?
Well, and there can be an attack on these things too, as happened with the Dobbs decision overturning Roe versus Wade. It was sort of a death by a thousand cuts, right? I mean, they took cases up that just chipped away at the decision till finally the Supreme Court overturned it.
And you're right. And they made sure that as they were chipping away, they were, again, very strategically and masterfully working to put certain pieces in place so as to eventually ensure a certain outcome, understanding that it would never be quick or easy or instantaneous. And that's precisely what happened. That's what I mean when I said earlier about forum shopping. You know, part of the mastery was not, I don't believe, it wasn't just ensuring that there was a certain balance on the highest court, meaning the Supreme Court. There was also masterful precision and focus on ensuring that the federal judiciary was situated in such a way as to create essentially a funnel to that ultimate decision. It had to go through somewhere. And so helping to ensure that those lower federal courts were also well positioned, strategically positioned to respond a certain way was part of, I think, a larger strategy. And again, it was long game. It took time, but it worked.
So President Biden is suggesting 18-year term limits for Supreme Court justices, a binding and enforceable ethics code for justices, and a constitutional amendment prohibiting blanket immunity for presidents. Now, in the last segment, I'm going to talk about what he didn't talk about. When President Biden was running for election against then-sitting President Trump, there were a lot of questions about the Supreme Court that came up during that election. President Biden danced around them pretty much and said he would set up a commission to look at perhaps reform of the Supreme Court. Well, he did that in 2020. He fulfilled his campaign promise. He set up a commission. A lot of legal scholars, constitutional experts from around the country. And in December of 2021, which is exceptionally fast for a commission to issue a report in the federal government, they issued a 295-page report, but didn't make any specific recommendations. But part of that was talking about whether to expand the number of justices on the court. In other words, should President Biden add more justices that he could appoint, thereby diluting the conservative overwhelming majority on the court and bringing things back into balance? There's not a word in the op-ed piece about adding more justices to the court.
And
what
rightfully
do you think
so.
Is going on?
I think that is the smartest.
You think that's right?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you why. Well, first of all,
I might disagree with you on this one, but go right ahead.
I'm going to invite that. But first of all, I don't know how you issue a 300-page report and make zero recommendations. I'm not certain if maybe, 75 or 100 of those pages are just coloring pages.
So, well, come on now. You've read academic reports.
They're just doodling. Like you said, this 17 times in like the four chapters before, but 300 pages and not one recommendation, and you're a task force. That just kind of dodges the whole point of being a task force. But okay, folks. But here's
sort of
what
the Warren Commission of Supreme
Courts, right? Just like, really? This is what we've done. But here's my position with regard to court expansion. I think that for as much as we do not, and we would like to not believe that the court is a is a political mechanism. I think if nothing else, we've been reminded in the last year or so that it absolutely is. And it definitely has political underpinnings. We've seen it at work and we know what happens. Here's what we also know. We know that the sentiment of the American people, given the court, the way it's currently constituted, the sentiment of the American people has shown us over history that over a period of time in history that we prefer sometimes to be led by Democratic presidents. And there are other times when we prefer to be led by Republican presidents. And there are all kinds of things that happen in the world and in society that lead us to those changing of the guard. Same things happen in Congress, whether it's the House or the Senate. That's why we constantly see those branches of government in flux, if you will. What President Biden, I believe, is avoiding is the very thing I believe court expansion would invite, which is what I like to call judicial retaliation. If in fact there is an expanding of the Supreme Court, number of Supreme Court justices under a Democratic president in an effort that is perceived to be exclusively for the purpose of diluting the voting power of conservative justices, then what will happen is the Republican Party or the other party will play the long game, as they should, and they will patiently wait for the executive branch to then be run by their political party, and they will retaliate by then appointing more justices that will now dilute the voting power of the existing democratically controlled or seemingly democratically controlled Supreme Court. There could be potentially no end to the seesaw back and forth retaliation between Republican or Democratic justices as appointed, and you would have no real way to put this in check. And that, I think, would become absolute mayhem. What stops the Supreme Court from becoming, you know, a bench of, you know, 35, 42, 47, or whatever, just out of, again, this beast of what could be political retaliation. I really do think that anytime there's an election, instead of people being able to rely on the steadiness, perceived steadiness of the Supreme Court, what they will then brace themselves for is another sea change from the court, not just from the executive and legislative branches, but also from the court. One of the benefits I think that we've had, at least in the past, is that even when the executive branch changed and even when there were changes in Congress, we could rely on a steady, objective judiciary to help to be the cornerstone of democracy. And I think that something like this could upset it all.
All right. My rebuttal is that I'm not sure it's a good thing to expand the number, but I would hold that card very close to my vest, and I would use that as the bargaining chip to get term limits. Say, look, if we don't get term limits, we're going to go for expansion of the court, because it cannot stay status quo. And so you don't want term limits? Fine. We'll add more justices to the court. And there's historical precedent for this going back to FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when he was trying to get through his New Deal, and the court was saying, no, unconstitutional, no, 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 no. He tried to stack the court by getting more justices. It didn't work. But I think he made his point with the court, even though it failed to actually stack it. So I think it's more of a bargaining chip than a reality, but it could be if none of the other reforms go through.
And I think that would be the case if we were dealing with, you know, rational people.
Reasonable people. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah. I kind of tried to decide which word would best suit it. But yes, if I thought that there were reasonable folks on both sides that would actually take a response to that to heart and say, hey, well, you know what, you're right. We don't really want to see that kind of expansion. So, you know, since we're in the business of deal making and finding middle ground, the middle ground would probably be something reasonable like term limits. Okay, that's you know, maybe that's a, you know, extra strength Tylenol pill to swallow as opposed to a big old, you know, penicillin pill that gets stuck in your throat. So you can swallow that one. The problem, however, is that the response is very likely to be, go ahead, we'll be back eventually. And when we are, we'll just do our thing. And so that's fine. And in the meantime, we're going to do everything we can to delegitimize what you've just done, because we're kind of, you know, sharpening our tools in that wheelhouse as well. And so where you now have low approval ratings for the Supreme Court, if stacking it or adding more justices is clearly seen as a way to dilute the voting power of certain justices, then I promise you, those who are not in support of it are going to swallow a bullhorn and they're going to scream it from the mountaintops how absolutely unfair this is and how it's being purposely designed to strip away and fill in the blank, anything you want to put right there. And in addition to that, that makes them illegitimate. That, I think, just erodes even more. It really makes it makes everything more fragile.
Well, I think that that's probably why President Biden didn't put it in his op-ed piece. I think you've probably summarized it very well. We're out of time, Judge Gail. How do people find us? What do they do if they do find us?
Oh, we're hoping you enjoy these podcasts and these conversations with the brilliant Judge Tom Hodson here on Next Witness, Please. You can find us on every major platform where you find your favorite podcasts, wherein we should become one of them. So look for us on Amazon, Spotify, NPR, all of your favorite on Apple iTunes. You can find us anywhere, again, where you find your podcast. We're going to ask that you tune in, that you follow us, that you rate us, and that you come back for more, because we are enjoying the opportunity to help you gain better understanding of this justice and legal system.
And if you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can email it to me at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. If you have a question about some aspect of the law or something that you would like for us to cover in the future, you can suggest that too. Again, that's hodson@ohio.edu. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gail and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Judge Gail, it's always a pleasure.
Pleasure's all mine, Judge Tom. Thank you again.
And have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.